So, I think I told you a couple weeks ago, I'm actually going to be out again next week. I have the privilege of doing another wedding. I love doing weddings. That's one of the best parts of this job. It's kind of cool when it's your own kids too, you know, but I love it when it's my spiritual kids. Emily Carlone's going to get married next weekend up in Rhode Island, so I'll be doing that. So I thought, again, you know, I don't think I really want to start a series today because I'll be out again next week. So it's another opportunity to just kind of do a standalone sermon. And the obvious thing is that it's Father's Day. So I thought, you know, maybe why not just do a Father's Day message? I mean, Father's Day, as you know, is not technically in the Bible, but obviously thematically it's all over the Bible. What's interesting is, you know me, I had to do my sweating of research and just see what happened with Father's Day. So I checked it out, and it was actually the church that is credited with starting Father's Day. Way back, I think it was 1908, that there was a horrible mining accident in West Virginia, and it said 361 fathers died in the mining accident. There was 1,000 kids that were orphans as a result of that, and they decided, you know what, we need to just have a service to honor fathers, you know, just these fathers that had passed, and to not take for granted those that still have their fathers. And so they started it that Sunday, and it kind of picked up momentum with other churches over the years. So you thought it was Hallmark, right, trying to market up business. It was the church. Anyway, there's a lot of different topics we could do on Father's Day. We could talk about, you know, the fatherhood itself. Honoring your father is one of the big 10, right? Could talk about that. Lack of fatherhood. We could talk about fatherhood of God, which we've already kind of mentioned just in worship. So I was thinking about it. You know what I'd like to do? I'm going to talk to you as your spiritual father today. I know I'm a lot younger. I'm not that much younger than anybody anymore, but I am getting old enough that I am older than a lot. Been kind of in given the responsibility of just nurturing and discipling this congregation now for almost 19 years. And I just kind of thought, you know what? Maybe I'll just speak to you as your pastor, as your spiritual father, and just kind of talk to you a little bit about some of the things that I see, maybe some of my concerns, and what some of my hopes are when it comes to just being the father of this little community of faith that we have here. I think one of the things that is neat about our congregation that is actually unique, and that was even, I think, observed when we went to our retreat last November with the Howards. And Susan Howard even said herself that she felt it was the Lord impressing on her that there was something very unique and beautiful about our little congregation. And that was that it had a sense of family. And I think that's really true. I think there really is a kind of a sense of family here. But the thing is, with family, you can get that sense of community or family with a lot of different things. You know, I was even impressed how Eric was telling me he's been working at the restaurant now for over a year, and how they really came and supported him in a lot of ways, just as his fellow workers at the restaurant when they found out about the fact that, you know, his brother had passed away a couple weeks ago and wanted to help him out in whatever way they could. And it kind of was almost like Tina and I felt a little embarrassed, like, geez, you know, maybe we should have called our troops a little more on board to just step it up a little bit. But there is a real sense of family in a lot of things. I know TK and Jan, I bet you could, I know you could testify that there's something, I remember the Loudies telling me, that there's something very unique when your kids get involved in sports. And there's almost like a sense of community that starts to happen amongst the parents. something that I never really got the full impact of, but, you know, just going to a few things with my son here and there, I can imagine how the momentum, how that must be, it just can be such a bonding thing that each week you go to see your kids play a particular sporting event. I remember Paul and Wendy Loudy saying that even after Evan was done playing college baseball, that they still get together with the parents years later because there was such a sense of community that they developed with all the other parents. I'm like, well, what do we need church community then for? I mean, these people are doing it as good as we are, and quite honestly, in some cases, they're doing it better than we are. So what do we need it for? Well, I think the one defining difference and responsibility that we have as a community is that we're not only here and called to call, you know, to care for each other physically, financially, whatever ways it may be, but we have a spiritual element that we're to care about each other's souls. That there's something within us that doesn't just live on after we die, but it's the most important and valuable commodity that God has entrusted to each and every one of us. If you look at the signs, you know, I was thinking about it, I said, let me just look at those signs. Did you ever read those? You know, what do they call it? Habituate, when you just get used to something being a certain way and you don't even notice it anymore. You know, like you have that broken door and you don't even remember, or it's just a natural thing, you know, second nature. You get up to the door and you know you have to lift it to get it open, and then you walk in until somebody else comes in. Hey, you know, there's something wrong with your door. There is? Oh, yeah, that's right. You got to just lift, you know. So you probably come in here and you don't even notice the signs, but there's two signs out there. One says this property, one says this church. And it's just to remind us that this property originally was for saving lives, and then it was purchased by the church in 1947, and now the facility is used for saving souls, or for the keeping of people's spiritual health. And so I think that's something that we have to remember. I remember even Susan said, as she was looking at our family, and she said, it's a place where people need to come. It should be a place where people can come and feel safe and be vulnerable. And then the one point that makes us different, and find an anchor for their souls. Find an anchor for their souls. I have mentioned a while back that I want to do a series on the soul. I think it's such an interesting, intriguing topic. I read that there was a survey once that was taken of people in church, and, you know, first just asking if, you know, they believed they had a soul, and almost everybody did, but then when they were asked to describe what it is, they couldn't do it. We grew up with saying, now I lay me down to sleep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my... What is it exactly that he takes? Jesus says it's the most valuable commodity that he has entrusted to each and every one of us. We've all heard that scripture, right? Matthew 16, verse 26, it says, where is it here? Here's 27. Now 26 is supposed to come before that. There it is. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Some versions say lose his soul. Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? How valuable it is. What's interesting is we always hear that quoted. But I found it very interesting the cost that Jesus says there is in not losing that soul is right the two verses just before that. Just before he quotes that, he says this in verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, for whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Then he says, for what will it profit a man? It's pretty amazing because I spend a lot of time trying to just save my life and make it safer. And he's saying there's something about being willing to lose your life and surrender those things for him. And you'll end up hanging on to the most valuable thing that he's entrusted to us. Now, the thing is for me that I never was that, by the world standards, all that successful. I never had that much to surrender or lose as far as this world goes. Now, globally, I know I'm probably one of the richest people on the planet. What are we, in the top 90% of the entire 7 billion people on the planet? So I am a rich man. But as far as this country goes, I never really did that well, you know, made any great investments and had hotels and houses and things like that, except in one experience that I would have frequently, Monopoly. Right? We've all kind of had that experience. And that's a great one, isn't it? And I think we can all kind of relate. I mean, that was the one game that I learned. You can never win unless you're willing to take risks. You know? I mean, that is if you don't want to just play for second place, right? You just do that thing and it's like, I don't care, man. Whenever I land on a property, if nobody owns it, I'm buying it. You know? And you just buy it and you just know that, you know, buying every piece of property that you land on. And if you don't have the money after a while, then you just mortgage one of your other ones, you know, so you can just buy it. And because you know that accumulation is the name of the game, and how much money you have is how you keep score. And so you just keep going and keep going, and you use, as you do it more, you get more skill and passion, and then you just go with reckless abandon, buying everything as much as you can, and after a while, you realize it actually happens. You become the master of the board, and nobody can hurt you. You're the master of the board because you have control of everything that's going on in there. And then eventually, one of your opponents, maybe all of them, finally land one too many times on Boardwalk, or praise the Lord, on Park Place, and you own it, and they have to just surrender what money they have left, and they have to take their little race car marker and put it away. And the game is yours. It's just total commitment to acquisition. That's the name of the game. But the greatest lesson of the game is a title of a book from which I got this from John Ortberg. And the title of his book is When the Game is Over, It All Goes Back in the Box. All the houses, all the hotels, all the properties that you have acquired, even Park Place and Boardwalk, the railroads, the utilities, all those thousands of dollars, when the game is over, it all just goes back in the box. And you can get all steamed up about it, and you can get really excited about it, you know, and you forget that the game's, you almost feel like it's not going to end, and you get so involved with it, like it's going to last forever, but it won't. Not going to last forever for me, for you, for nobody. And that's the deal. So how do we play the game in the light of this truth? The psalmist had this to say in Psalm 90, verse 12, right? He said, teach us, Lord. Teach us, Lord, to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Human beings, I'm not a nature specialist, but I think that human beings are probably the only created thing that God has that we are able to think ahead and know that we will have to put everything back in the box and the game will be over. I don't think my cats know that. You know, they have a survival instinct, certainly, but I don't think Oscar goes around like, you know, maybe I'll make it to 20, you know? Yeah, I don't think Felix walks around like, well, you know, their last cat made it to 22. You know, but we think that way. I mean, my father made it to 79. Sometimes I wonder, you know, is that going to be the same for me? Jesus said, work while it's yet day, because a night's going to come when your opportunity is over. I always say that. One cartoon I saw, where, remember the guy, is he still around, or maybe somebody took his job? Used to be a guy when I was younger that was at every football game. And every time they were by the goal, you'd see him there with that huge sign, John 3:16, you know? And there was some cartoon that showed the guy up in heaven with the same thing, John 3:16. And the angel was like, listen, buddy, you don't have to do that anymore. Yeah. You know, everybody is in heaven. They're saved. This is our one opportunity to work while it's yet day. There's a time when that's not going to be needed anymore. And it can be a little bit of a curse, understanding that one day the game's going to be over. And it can be a blessing. It actually can hopefully make us take advantage more of the opportunities that God's giving us. And the psalmist is no different. He says, listen, I want to number my days. I want to count my days because I want my days to count. And I know it's kind of a serious topic, maybe even feel a little morbid today, but you know what? G.K. Chesterton, I found this quote of his. He said this, that while we often can take ourselves too seriously, which I think we can. That's why I like to joke around a little bit. Loosen up, you know? Especially in church, people tend to be, come on, you know? Cut it out, will you? Jeez, God likes to have fun. Take yourself so seriously. But then he ends with this, but we can hardly take our souls seriously enough, according to what Jesus said. What does it matter if you gain the whole world? So as your spiritual father, that's what I see. We have this propensity to just, I think, put the temporary as our primary and the eternal as our secondary. There's just this gravitation, you know? And that's why I think it's important that at least, at a minimum, we come somewhere we can present these truths before us and remind us where our priorities need to lie. And what it's all about. I remember Pastor Bill Hybels had an exercise years ago where he would say, take one of those sticky note pads and just write on a bunch of them, temporary. And just go around and stick them on stuff. You know, put it on your TV, put it on your car, you know, put it on your refrigerator, your carpet, your new wood floor, Jimmy, you know. Hand it out to them, you know, after they pay all that money. Temporary. It's temporary. It's all going to burn, you know. But that's important to do. But also, he said, then take a bunch of pads and pieces of paper and write eternal on it. Stick one on your spouse's forehead and let them stick one on yours. Put one on your kids. Put one on your enemies. Put one, if you can't get close enough to them or you're too annoyed to, but maybe in your mind's eye, put one on that person in front of you that's annoying you on the highway. Dallas Willard said this. He says, they are all an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. Man, we just forget that. How huge that is. And you know what? Take one of those eternal stickers. Put one on yourself. You got one soul. Take care of it. Take it seriously. We can tend to take ourselves too seriously, but you can never take your soul too seriously. So that's what I see, and here's my concern, which I've kind of already implied, and that is that physical sickness, man, that gets our attention. And we buy insurances in case we need to literally spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on it to keep it in place. In fact, been there, done that in the last couple of years. I just wanted to check the bills out just to see, like, what does a stem cell replacement cost these days? It was like a house. It's crazy. Like $300,000 for 2 weeks in a hospital. It's nuts. But we'll do whatever it takes. I'll do whatever it takes to defy physical sickness, but somehow we can resign ourselves to soul sickness. And Jesus said it's so much more important. It's the most valuable thing that God has entrusted to any of us. And the problem is the world just doesn't teach us these things. We're surrounded to just pay attention to all this stuff that doesn't really matter. You know, I think I've said before, somebody said somewhere that the thing that is not the worst thing that could happen to you is not failure. It's succeeding at things that don't matter. Completely absorb our lives in them. And we're all about what we have accomplished rather than what we are becoming. Everything motivates us to want to change our circumstances and our situation. And Jesus wants us to be motivated to change our souls, that they'd be redeemed. So I'm going to just look at a story here for a little bit that I'm sure most of us are familiar with, that Jesus talked about. And I think there's a way of looking at this for sure, how it has to do with our souls. Matthew 4, verses 2 through 8, when he talks about a guy planting seeds. You've heard this one, right? The sower and the seed. Sower is planter. Sowing is planting. Okay? So, chapter 4, I'll just begin at verse 1 in Mark. It says, Jesus began to teach again by the sea. And such a very large crowd gathered to him that he got into a boat in the sea and sat down, and the whole crowd was by the sea on the land. And he was teaching them many things in parables and was saying to them in his teaching, listen to this. Behold, the sower, the planter, went out to sow, to plant. And as he was sowing, some seed fell beside the road, or on the path, some versions say. And the birds came and ate it up. Other seed fell on the rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and immediately it sprang up because it had no depth of soil. And after the sun had risen, it was scorched, and because it had no root, it withered away. Other seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked it, and it yielded no crop. Other seeds fell into the good soil, and as they grew up and increased, they yielded a crop and produced 30, 60, and 100 fold. One of the things that I remember when it comes to looking at Jesus' parables is look at the constants and look at the variables. Look at the things that stay the same, and then look at the things that change. And it will help you to get to the point of what Jesus is trying to make. First of all, what's constant? First of all, it's the seed. It's not like he's planting bad seed and good seed. It's all good seed. But the seed will take root, actually, if you just give it any room at all. You ever notice that? How sometimes a seed will happen to just fall in the crack of cement, and you see that plant coming up in the middle of it? I think that's a picture of how God's desire is. If we just give him a crack, man, he can get that seed in there and germinate it and begin to do something with our souls. But that's the first thing, is there aren't different seeds. They're all the same seed. It's God's seed. It's good seed. It's fertile seed. The sower is also constant. He's the same. It's not like one farmers planting, you know, bad seeds, or he's a bad planter and doesn't really know how to do it. And another farmer knows how to plant them properly. So those are grown and they grow up the proper. The farmer plants them all the same way. He's actually very generous. So he just sounds like he's throwing all this seed everywhere. And he just scatters it. Where it gets interesting, what changes, where the variable is the soil. The soil is what determines what's going to happen. So I think we could replace the soil with the word soul. Condition is your soul in. Now we can look at this as people who aren't saved or people that haven't heard the gospel yet, and that's absolutely true, but I think we can apply it to ourselves too. The first one is seed that fell on the path. In the Middle East, it's a dry climate. It can be a hot climate. And you get an area where people are walking all the time. It was along the side of the road where pedestrians would go, or maybe farmers or herders would take their sheep, and it would just get packed down hard. And he said that's the first area that Jesus looks at, that the seed can't take root because it's hard. That's the hardened soul. And I'll tell you what, being in ministry for 19 years, and I've said this before, I'm going to just say it again, being a Christian for over 30-some years, it's interesting the perspective that you start to get, because you see souls start to get hardened. You know, it's kind of neat when you go to a more youthful church, or where it's a, you know, they have churches that are almost geared towards young people, and that's awesome. You know, it reels them in. But it's almost like, man, you know, let's see where you're at in 30 years, you know. When you see your kids don't quite go the way maybe you thought they were supposed to go, or you were praying and hoping and planning on them going. Let's see where your faith is at when, you know, your job or your finances or your health or your kid's health or your spouse's health. Or list just goes on, and things just don't really go the way that you thought God was supposed to make everything go. And if you're not careful, it has a way of hardening your soul. And you kind of get in the habit of going to church, but man, you just have that blank stare. And you're just kind of going through the motions because your soul gets hardened. It happens all the time. I mean, I guess the first soul that's listed in the Bible that was hardened was Cain. It always seems like it's brothers that are getting hardened. You know? Cain gets hardened against Abel. He's jealous of his brother. And then you got Jacob, who gets hardened against Esau. You got David's brothers, whose their soul was hardened against him. And then you got David's sons, and they get hardened souls against each other. And it's just all these different factors that can come in. And you know what can happen is I think that sometimes we can get so focused on the things that have hurt us that we become so self-focused and thinking about the things that haven't gone the way that we felt they should go, that we stop examining our souls and we become looking at how we're a victim. And all we do is look at everything that has victimized me and made me, all these terrible things that have come my way, and in the process, the devil is subtly hardening your heart against others and ultimately against God himself. So what do we do? Well, when Jesus said, you want to take care of the most important commodity that I've entrusted to you, your soul, what did he say before that? He said, you got to deny yourself. You know, sometimes I think just the smallest act of self-denial has a way of breaking up a hard heart. I mean, that's the whole concept that so many groups, that's the concept that AA uses. Stop looking at your own problem and go out and try and find somebody else to help. Bill Wilson found it was a biblical principle that exploded to get people out of their alcoholism, to not just focus on their own, but go out and help somebody else. And you'll find out your problem stays in line. I think we'll be surprised when we get our mind at times off our own situation And just even if they're tiny little sacrifices for other people, it works an interior magic inside of us. It kind of puts, maybe we could say, ourselves a little bit on the side so that God can take the center again. Just a little bit of softness in the soul can make a big difference. An acorn's only this big, right? You just give it a little space and it starts to grow and it can crack up a whole driveway, right? Maybe you're dealing with that right now. Give God's seed a chance. It makes huge differences on the hardened soul. The next one, it says that it fell on soil that had all these rocks. But the point is not the rocks, I don't think. I think the point is that the soil was so shallow. The shallow soul. Man, that's another thing. I think the world is just constantly trying to get us into superficial things. Richard Foster, I love that book of his, Celebrating the Disciplines. And in that he says, superficiality is the curse of our age. How many billions of dollars are just spent on trying to get the outside to look a certain way through cosmetic surgery or cosmetics themselves and all of these things? I mean, I was just blown away. Tina was blown away. You know, she found out, you know, she said, I don't think I've ever spent more than $8 on a lipstick. And then you go with the younger kids and you find out, man, go to Mac and Sephora and it's like $30 for, you know, it's like all of this stuff and it just constantly dragging us in, and the soul is made for depth and the world is constantly looking to just keep us on the surface. The psalmist cries us back out often to those deeper things, right? Used to be a song years ago. As the deer pants for the streams of water, my soul pants for you. So dried up with all this surface stuff. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Deep calls to deep in the roar of your waterfalls. The Bible makes us to understand that our soul is the deepest part of us. It's the only way we're going to discover contentment. And the only thing that can bear the full weight of this deep expanse of our soul is God Himself. So one comment I thought was kind of interesting. It says, you know, the soul is the only thing in ancient writers, as well as biblical writers, that addresses the soul in the third person because it's so deep. It never says, you know, talking to the body or the mind, but it talks to the soul. Why are you downcast, my soul? There's a depth to it that I think goes beyond any other part. We need to observe it. We need to reflect on it. That whole thing with the stickers of eternal and temporary and realizing, man, just having a conscious awareness of an eternal perspective on things. Connectedness to God will give us depth of soul like nothing else. In fact, I saw that the Bible actually uses a word in the Greek often to describe eternity without God, and it's the word from which we get our word abyss, which is really what the soul is like without God. It's just this vast, empty expanse. And the world just conspires to blind us to the depth of it and its need. And so it seldom experiences the deeper nourishment that it craves. The shallowness of the soul, the hardness of the soul, and the last one is the cluttered soul. I think this is the biggest one. Some seeds fall among thorns, and all these other plants grow up, and they just kind of choke it. the worries of life, the deceitfulness of wealth, and Jesus' explanation of it. You know, this is the only parable where Jesus gives a full, complete explanation of it. It's in three of the Gospels. It's the first parable that Mark gives. It's very important, I think, the way the biblical writers position it. And he says that the worries of this life, deceitfulness of wealth, desire for other things, choke the soul. Somebody said a long time ago, if the devil can't get you into sin, he'll just make you busy. You've heard that one, right? Busy, B-U-S-Y, being under Satan's yoke. I mean, it's tough. I mean, yesterday, you know, Tina and I are just trying to find some time to pray. You know, let's just try and take 15 minutes, you know, and then it's like, oh, geez, okay, Alyssa's promotion ceremony. We got to leave in 20 minutes. Oh, I wanted to drop something off the TK for the garage sale. And then we got, you know, it's just one thing after another, and it's like your soul just gets cluttered, and there's so many other things. You know, if you don't make your calendar will make your schedule for you. And it's amazing how many times we write down all of these other things, but we don't pencil in time for our soul tending, to take care of our souls. I wrote one thing down here. I saw it said, it takes a little, such a tiny little uncluttered space to give the seed some room to grow. The cluttered soul is closer to being saved and having health than you really know, because it craves it so much. It needs softness, depth, and space, but the world won't help much with that, will it? That's Father's Day and what your father here at the church has to say. That's what I see, that's my concern, and I'm just going to end with a minute here about what my hope is. And really, it's pretty obvious. My hope is that we'll just make a renewed, conscious, and heightened effort to remind ourselves that the most important thing that we possess is our soul. And as your pastor, I'd say the same thing for myself and all of you. Here's what Hebrews 13:17 says. Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. Now listen, if anybody knows me at all, you know I feel real uncomfortable to have to say something to you like, you know, you've got to obey and submit to me. But that's what the Bible says. You know, it's what it says. But what makes me more uncomfortable is it says this, I will have to give an account for your souls. That's intense. That's heavy duty. I can only love and tell you these things. I don't know what you may be doing. I don't know where your soul condition is. And you can come in here and you can look great and I'll have no idea. But what good is that? That's why I'm praying that we could have more and more a place where people feel safe to, as we say, bear their soul. What are we going to come in here and just, you know, what good is that? So you come in and everybody thinks that you got this great reputation, and then we have to stand before God with this soul that's in a terrible, tattered state. And what are we going to say to God? Well, at least all of them down there, I still have a good reputation. What good is that? To bear our soul. So it doesn't get cluttered, it doesn't get shallow, it doesn't get hardened, it doesn't shrivel up. We don't care about our souls the way we do our physical being. You know, the funny thing is in the physical being, if we don't take care of it, eventually it starts to show, right? But that's not always the case when it comes to the soul. God sees it. I saw something in Exodus 33. And I really am going to end with this. I thought this was interesting. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, and he said, 'Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites.'" Wow, I got through that one. He's going to drive them all out. "Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst because you are an obstinate people and I might destroy you." I thought, that's wild. God says, go ahead. I'm going to give you the promised land. You can have it if you want. But I'm not going to go with you. I heard one guy say at a pastor's conference, you know, he kind of just felt like God was saying, all right, you want a big church? Go ahead. Go ahead. You can have it. But I'm not going with you. I'll give it to you. I'll even send an angel along, but I'm not going to go with you. Moses said this. Then he said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. I just felt like, God, I don't want to go anywhere if you're not going to go with us. God, our souls are lost. We can accomplish things on the outside, but if you don't go with us, what a waste. Second Timothy 3:16 says this, "All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, training, and righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." All of Scripture, that's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of things we can do that this gives us to help us tend our souls and keep them healthy. I'm going to just leave you with one that I see all over Scripture. Matthew 14:23. After Jesus had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Mark 6:46. After bidding them farewell, Jesus left for the mountain to pray. Luke 6:12. It was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer with God. If Jesus had to do this, where does that leave us? Then what should we be doing? He spent the whole night. Luke 9:28 says this. He took along others with him. Now he goes to pray and he takes others with him. So there's things we need to do ourselves to tend souls, but then we need to do it together also. It says, he took along Peter, John, and James, and he went up the mountain to pray. And I think a lot of this is my fault. I don't even know if you guys remember. We have prayer here every Tuesday night. I don't go up any mountain, but I go up those stairs every Tuesday. And I'm just going to ask, I know that you're really busy. It's tiring. You have a lot to do. But just make sure it's not just cluttering your soul. And maybe there's a few of you that I could take with me when we go up our little mountain.